I want to do a little podcast introducing to the Web 2.0 module. The reason is twofold. First of all, because podcasting is one of these new Web 2.0 technologies, and I found it appropriate to use this technology to add to the media richness of this module. Secondly, because I am doing a little review on a newly published book, Podcasting for Learning in Universities, edited by Gilly Salmon and Palita Dirisinger, and I thought the best idea to get what is involved in producing a podcast and looking at how a podcast is liked by students, for instance, is to try to produce one myself. Okay, and now we start. I give a short overview over over the module. Essentially, we have a first part which deals with definitions and examples. Then we have a second part which looks at Web 2.0 under three perspectives. Web 2.0 viewed as business model, Web 2.0 viewed as a bundle of technologies, and Web 2.0 viewed as a set of social practices. The focus, the main focus in this module is actually to look at Web 2.0 as a business model. Partly because this is an economics class, but also partly because the term Web 2.0 essentially was coined by O'Reilly, convening a conference with the aim of exploring which characteristic features are common in those companies which survived the 2002.com shakeup. Okay, and certainly it is fascinating for me to see how these companies, which are very well known for providing services for free, become so rich. So I focused on a bit on this business model side, and then being so pleased with this business model is obviously the question, could it be replicated in the field of education? Could we replicate it in distance education? What is the impact then? So in the remaining part of my little podcast, I therefore want to focus on these three things. First of all, definition. Secondly, business model, and thirdly, the question, can we replicate it? So first thing is the definition. Generally in education, when you introduce, in science and academia, when you introduce a new term, you do it using this Aristotelian approach of introducing a new term with a definition by relating it to a more generic term, general term, and then identifying the specific differences to characterize your term. And if you try to do this with Web 2.0, you are likely to fail. There are no good sort of Aristotelian definitions of Web 2. Nevertheless, it seems, and it is fascinating, that people can nicely communicate about Web 2.0. To understand how they can do that, I think the notion that Wittgenstein introduced sometimes in his philosophical investigations about family resemblance is quite instructive. You can see in a family, you can see these members, family members are a bit similar, but still all may not share a common trait. But there's enough overlap that pairs and subsets share several traits. Some share the red hair, some the hooked nose, and so on, to see them as similar. So this is also that the case with Web 2, people successfully communicate about it, but it defies a sort of Aristotelian definition. So therefore I need to introduce the family members to you in order to that you get a hang of the family resemblances, and for this I introduced the examples. The examples are probably not very exhaustive, very instructive for people who follow these things, but I think they summarize some sort of characteristic information. Therefore, they introduce you to this zoo of Web 2.0 family members or animals. Then we come to the definition as point two. We come to the definition of the business model. The interesting feature of Web 2.0 as a business model is to cite the Google slogan, you can get rich without doing evil. So actually they say they do good and become rich. You offer free services and still you become rich. And this seems to fly in the face of what economists teach and tell, that there are no free lunches. An interesting thing to investigate. What is a characteristic feature that these business models can survive? And as you see in my model, it is this, what I call this Janus phase. They have on the one side, they offer to the general public something for free, and on the backstage they deal with proper customers and there is revenue flowing. What is a core ingredients for a successful Web 2.0 business model is you must know that you deal in the realm of the digital world, the world of information mainly, and you use a web as a portal. So this is already important because knowledge and information is to some extent very different from the physical goods like breads and motor cars and things like that. So physical goods like bread you cannot share without losing something, and information in a way you can share without losing it. And actually you can offer these information services over the web to all sorts of people without depriving other people from using the information, and that this public good character of information goods, this public good character says these goods defy the notion of scarcity, the logic of scarcity. These goods follow a different logic. They are non-exhaustive. And that means actually that when you have a good business idea, you can have any number of customers. And the good business idea is you offer people that they can do something what they anyway want to do or what they need to do. For instance, searching is what they need to do, and uploading photos is an example of what many people want to do. So you have a good business idea, and you offer these business your business services for free, and thereby, since you are dealing with in this digital world, non-exhaustible good, you can actually accommodate any number of customers. If you offer something for free, what the people need to do or must do, then you create logically a great stampede to your website, which in turn creates a great interest on the side of people who possibly want to place adverts, because there's on your site there's a big audience visiting your site, and that is a place where you have to place your adverts, and therefore you can sort of backstage broker access to the information or the goods or the customers in sort of willy-nilly produce as I call it digital traces or digital content, and you can broker these access backstage and satisfy the front stage the general public free. So that's a good thing. And then I have two subtopics which are of some interest, specifically the sub-surveillance. And there's another topic on exploitation. You can judge to which extent you find that relevant. Since I am already 13 minutes talking, I want now come to the last element, which is can we replicate this model? What impact actually it has on education, in particular on distance education? And my take of this situation is that when we look at the costing framework we have developed here, the fixed cost and the variable cost, fixed cost of development of material and variable cost mainly coming from sustaining communication with teachers. Then you can hear in discussions with experts on conferences very often two comments which are sort of relating to these type of things. First of all, people say it is all there on the web. You don't invent Seville another time. It's all there. You only go there and get it. Therefore, we can sort of, the recommendation is do not invest or squander money in reinventing the wheel, developing new resources, sort of get a free ride on what is already there. This is the argument, the web is already rich, there are increasingly even open educational resources available, and thirdly, the technical barriers for the users themselves to become producers and produce content themselves is good, a constructivist educational instructional design. Therefore, you should go for this one instead of squandering money, too much money, into course development. That is this side. And the other side is on teacher-student communication is a bit related to this argument of harnessing the witness as the intelligence of the masses, saying these new technologies allow networking features so that you must open your institution wide enough, and enough people must contribute, and then you see these wonders of Wikipedia happening, and there are enough people to help themselves and teach themselves, and then put these together, the availability of good resources and the widely distributed expertise of people willing to contribute and to help, then you can really bring down the cost of education, which really would almost enable you to offer your services at a very low cost and almost for free. So the idea maybe backstage you can also broker access to these to your big student base and therefore have a sort of revenue flow from which you can get rich. The central argument, my central argument here is, it is true that we should make use of already developed resources, and we should also encourage sort of learners to contribute themselves. But essentially, I believe that it's not working as a business model, and it is really a slippery slope to go if we want to do all these things for cost reduction. So basically, I think it will not work, and we should not go for it on for these type of reasons. So I'm already close to 20 minutes, and therefore I think I should finish my little podcast and see what you think about it. Stop here.